Senta cambaleia e chora.
We're going to abandon your system and start all over because we believe another world is possible.
We're hoping that Germany will use its current position on the Security Council to vote no to any resolution that would authorize force against Iraq.
It's about life and death, and mostly death. The death of the soul of America.
Unfortunately, when he's going to come and stand up at that podium and beat the war drum for an hour and tell us that we must go after Saddam Hussein.
During these last few months, I've been trained by Al-Qaeda, and I'm weak and materialistic.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, January 28, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. President-elect Bush will seek to reassure an anxious nation about the faltering economy in a showdown with Iraq in his State of the Union address tonight, promising to, quote, rally the American people to some great causes, end quote. Democrats will challenge his approach on both fronts for the first time since the September 11th attacks transformed him into a popular wartime president. Bush faces serious questions about his leadership. Polls show most Americans don't approve of his handling of the economy, and only a bare majority support his foreign policies, an area where the president enjoyed support of more than 80% a year ago. After meeting with his cabinet today, Bush said, "I'm going in front of our nation to talk about the great challenges that face our country. There's no doubt that we'll be able to handle those challenges because we are a great country." In the 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time address to Congress and a global television audience, the White House said Bush was drawing from new evidence to argue that even U.N. inspections can't contain the threat posed by Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and its terrorist allies unless Saddam Hussein has a sudden change of heart. But the first half of Bush's address is devoted to domestic policy, a reflection of his desire not to let Iraq overshadow a presidential agenda geared toward the 2004 reelection campaign. Pacifica stations will carry the president's address live with progressive analysis and commentary from consumer advocate Ralph Nader, economist Julian Malveaux, political analyst Ronald Walters, and others immediately following tonight's speech. For the second time in as many weeks, the White House was confronted with the embarrassing legacy of United States support for Saddam Hussein in the Iraq-Iran war, in which Washington provided Iraq with some of the same weapons of mass destruction that are being condemned today. Peace Watch reporter Robert Knight has more from Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
During the Iraq-Iran war from 1981 to 1988, the Reagan administration, spooked by the Islamic Revolution in Iran, provided Iraq's new leader and CIA asset, Saddam Hussein, with logistical assistance, chemical weapons, and other materials as a buffer to protect oil interests in nearby Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. In Monday's White House press briefing, spokesperson Ari Fleischer deflected an early question about U.S. military aid to Iraq, but was later challenged with more specificity by the editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, Russell Mockheiber.
Russell?
Actually, a follow-up to the Iraq-U.S. alliance. The San Francisco Chronicle reported yesterday that a number of major American corporations, including Hewlett-Packard and Bechtel, helped Saddam Hussein beef up its military in the 80s. And also the Washington Post last month in a front page article by Michael Dobbs said the United States during the 80s supplied Iraq with cluster bombs, intelligence, and chemical and biological agents. In that same article, they reported Donald Rumsfeld, now Secretary of Defense, went to Baghdad in December 83 and met with Saddam Hussein. And this was at a time when Iraq was using chemical weapons almost on a daily basis in defiance of international conventions. So there are some specifics, and the question is, if Iraq is part of the axis of evil, why isn't the United States and these American corporations part of the axis of evil for helping him out during his time of need?
Russell, as I indicated, I think that you have to make a distinction between chemical and biological. And clearly, that in the previous era, following the fall of the Shah of Iran, when there was a focus on the risks that were underway in the region as a result of the rise of Islamic fundamentalism in Iran, different administrations, beginning with President Carter, reached different conclusions about the level of military cooperation vis-a-vis Iraq. Obviously, Saddam Hussein, since that time, has used whatever material he had for the purpose, therefore, of attacking Kuwait, attacking Saudi Arabia, attacking Israel. And obviously, as circumstances warrant, we have an approach that requires now the world to focus on the threat that Saddam Hussein presents, and that he presents this threat because of his desire to continue to acquire weapons and his willingness to use those weapons against others. Russell?
If I could follow up on it. You and the President have repeatedly said one of the reasons Saddam is part of the axis of evil is because he's gassed his own people. Well, he gassed his own people with our help. And you saw the Washington Post article, didn't you, by Michael Dobbs?
I think that statement is not borne out by the facts. I think that it gassed his own people as a result of his decisions to use his weapons to gas his own people. And I think the suggestion that you blame America for Iraq's actions is way beyond the pale.
White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer, along with Russell Mockheimer of the Corporate Crime Reporter, during yesterday's White House press briefing. More than a dozen American corporations were named in Iraq's recent weapons declaration as providing chemical warfare materials and precursors to Iraq with government sanction during the 1980s in a list that the Bush administration sanitized from public editions of that document. Moreover, according to an August 18th report from the New York Times, clandestine officers of the Defense Intelligence Agency confirmed that they provided Iraq with satellite photos of Iranian troop positions, coordinated battle plans, and looked the other way when Iraq used phosgene and other poison gases in the battle for the strategic Fal Peninsula and eventually against Kurds in northern Iraq as well. The Times quoted retired Colonel Walter Lang as saying the DIA, quote, would never have accepted the use of chemical weapons against civilians, but the use against military objectives was seen as inevitable in the Iraqi struggle for survival, end quote. Another officer was quoted as saying the use of poison gas on the battlefield was, quote, just another way of killing people, whether with a bullet or phosgene, it didn't make any difference, end quote. General Colin Powell, the current Secretary of State and then National Security Advisor, characterized the report as, quote, dead wrong, end quote. Robert Knight, Peace Watch, New York.
Speaking on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives last night, Seattle Democrat Jim McDermott warned his colleagues that Bush's speech tonight focuses on the wrong evil threat to the U.S. According to McDermott, the U.S. dependency on oil is akin to an addiction to heroin.
I heard a story on NPR recently which really disturbed me, having been a child psychiatrist for a number of years. Every child born in this century has a 100% chance of getting skin cancer if they're not protected very well during their lifetime. Because of the destruction of the space, what's going up in the air, ozone level, they are being subjected to rays of the sun that are going to make their skin into cancer. Now, the President of the United States could do all of this if he could simply say, we're not going to go to war to get 20% of the world's oil reserves. We're going to go in another direction. We're going to change the direction of this country. Unfortunately, when he's going to come and stand up at that podium and beat the war drum for an hour and tell us that we must go after Saddam Hussein, for he's never made it clear what we're going for, but it really is about oil. He won't admit that, but that's what it's about. And what makes me sad about what's going to happen tomorrow night is the American people are going to listen to that speech and think their only solution is to take Saddam Hussein out. If we take Saddam Hussein out, folks, you're going to be really safe. No one will have to worry. All the security will be settled. We'll be safe forever. Does anybody really think that the American people are going to believe that? I don't.
Seattle Democrat Jim McDermott speaking on the floor of the House of Representatives last night. The Bush administration has been downplaying the significance of the rich oil reserves in Iraq as an incentive for war. They continue to cite weapons of mass destruction as the reason for attacking Saddam Hussein. But Mike Renner, a senior researcher with World Watch Institute, in his book Post-Saddam Iraq, The Linchpin of a New Oil Order, helps us connect the dots and realize the interest in Iraq's oil is longstanding. Peace Watch spoke with Renner about his book and the impending war on Iraq.
Iraq plays or will play a very important role in the future oil industry because this country is in effect sitting on an ocean of very cheap oil, oil that has not been exploited very much up to now. And to the extent that the United States and other consumer countries continue to consume large amounts, actually growing amounts of oil, that to the extent that oil remains the centerpiece of the world's energy system, it will be inevitable that countries in the Middle East, and particularly Iraq, will play a very, very key role, because nowhere else in the world, no other region, no other country, do you have anything close to the amounts of resources that are in Iraq and that are likely to be, in addition to the existing ones, found in Iraq.
Not even Saudi Arabia? It's my understanding Saudi Arabia has begun to weigh into this equation to reassure the Bush administration that oil prices will, in fact, not increase if there's a war and that there's plenty of oil reserves available.
Well, of course, Saudi Arabia has, for a long time, really been the key piece in the oil puzzle. There's no question that at this point, Saudi Arabia has the largest confirmed oil reserves and has played a very important role as a swing producer a number of times when the energy markets were in a substantial crisis. However, it's also become quite clear since the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks that Saudi Arabia is no longer considered the very safe country and the very safe supplier of oil that it once unquestionably was. Of course, U.S.-Saudi relations have cooled considerably. And it seems, although decision-makers in Washington don't really say a whole lot about this, it clearly seems that the planning is going more and more in a direction that assumes that potentially Saudi Arabia may not be on good terms in the future. But it's also not entirely clear that the Saudi regime will actually manage to stay in power for a very long time. So in that regard, an alternative supply, and one that is under secure control of the United States, looks more and more important.
You talk about the Bush administration's close ties to the oil and gas industry in your report. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've discovered through your research?
Well, you know, I mean, of course, these ties of top officials in the administration to the oil industry, I mean, they're in certain individual cases, long history in the industry, is, of course, no secret or no new revelation. But it's curious that in all the discussion about the looming war with Iraq, that this is a connection that suddenly has sort of really fallen by the wayside. I mean, in most reports, particularly in the press in the United States, this is something that no longer is considered of any importance, supposedly.
And what are some of those ties, if you can just refresh our memory?
You know, take, for example, Vice President Cheney, who, of course, until he came into his current post, was the CEO of Halliburton, which is a company that, you know, is deeply involved in the industry. And other administration officials similarly have had a career in that industry, including President Bush. For anybody to argue that oil is not a factor in the policymaking now and in the planning, I think is simply quite preposterous.
Well, I've seen some reports that suggest that the Bush administration actually planned for this seizing of the Iraqi oil fields even prior to President Bush's arrival into the White House and to the presidency. Did your research address that at all? And if so, what did you discover?
Well, the research I did per se did not go into that aspect, but I think it's certainly fair to say that, yes, the focus on Iraq is something that in certain circles seems to be quite longstanding. Certainly a number of people who now find themselves in high positions in the administration, including Paul Wolfowitz in the Pentagon, have for a number of years argued very, very strongly for the kinds of policies that we are now seeing playing out. So I think this, too, is a strong reason to argue that there are longer-standing interests that are now coming into play rather than, say, a sudden discovery on the part of the administration once it came into office, realizing that Iraq presented some kind of threat that previously was not being acknowledged.
Mr. Renner, what about the specific oil company interests that have a stake in the future development of Iraq's oil reserves?
Well, I think any oil company will have quite a natural interest in Iraq, simply because there is a lot of oil to be found. The oil can be produced very, very cheaply. Informed sources say probably more cheaply than the oil in Saudi Arabia. And Iraqi oil is also of very high quality. So a number of contracts have been signed between these companies and the regime in Baghdad. On the other hand, U.S. and British companies have not participated in this, have basically been unable to do so, clearly because of the way the U.S. and British governments have acted vis-a-vis Iraq. So I think over the years it has been quite clear that if sanctions are ever lifted, that U.S. and British companies would be the big losers because they would be highly unlikely to get any significant share of the action. However,
and the other side of that, France and Germany would probably stand to benefit.
Well, any company that has lined up in such a way as the French and Russian companies have, I think, yes, would potentially stand to benefit. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also quite clear that a regime change in Baghdad would really, you know, reshuffle the cards and present a new game entirely. The big question, of course, is, you know, what exactly was the deal behind closed doors that was struck or likely struck when the Security Council Resolution 1441 was agreed upon in November of last year? Because there are a number of indications that the French and Russians and possibly the Chinese were saying to the Bush administration, look, if you want us to vote in favor of this resolution, you have to give us a good reason why. You have to give us some inducement. You have to give us some assurance that our oil companies will not lose out, that we at least still get a piece of the action.
Well, apparently the deal wasn't to France and Russia and China's liking. As we're seeing now, diplomatically, they're not really supporting the U.S.
Well, I think that these countries are, in a way, trying to play it both ways. They are still hoping that their existing contracts with the current regime will be honored. But in case that regime change does happen, and in case that questions come up of, well, it looks like you were supporting the regime of Saddam Hussein because you were engaging in contract negotiations with him, you were in effect giving him comfort and support, in case those kinds of arguments come up with a new regime, it's possible that otherwise these companies would lose out big time. So I think there is an effort to play it fairly safe on both options, both likely options that are before us now.
Michael Renner, your report seems to suggest that the human rights abuses of Saddam Hussein that are well documented, that he has allegedly imposed against his own people and some that we know he has imposed against his own people, are not really the underwriting or the driving force or motivation of the Bush administration for this war, that it's really all about oil. Is that your assertion?
Well, let me just say in the first place, I don't think it's only about oil or all about oil, but I think oil is one important factor. There are some other elements, I think, that other commentators have talked about in terms of what this means for the exercise of power globally, what it means for international law and international norms, and I think those are very important arguments. But still, I think oil is an important factor. As far as the issue of human rights is concerned, I find it very difficult to believe that this is a big motivating factor for the administration.
Why is that?
Well, there are a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, the United States has had very close and cordial relations with Saddam Hussein when he was a useful actor for the United States in the region, which primarily means when he decided to attack Iran, invade Iran in 1980, at a time when Iran was seen as the big enemy of the United States. The administrations back then, and that includes, of course, the father of the current president, were quite happy to work with the regime, no matter what its odious reputation was in the field of human rights. And I think there's no question that the Iraqi regime is one of the most murderous regimes that are on the face of this planet. That, I don't think, is at issue at all. I think what is at issue is whether the United States can actually be seen as a champion of human rights, and I think there the record is quite questionable. We also now see in the name of the war on terror that the United States is once more prepared to work with all kinds of regimes that do its bidding. let's consider Pakistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, countries in the region that have a very, very bad human rights record as well.
Mike Renner, senior researcher with World Watch Institute and author of the book Post-Saddam Iraq, The Linchpin of a New Oil Order. The Not in Our Name Project, an anti-war group formed in response to administration policies following the September 11th attack, called on people around the world yesterday to stop what they were doing for 1 hour and declare their opposition to war with Iraq, regardless of what the UN inspectors, the Security Council, or the U.S. government might say. Reem Khatouda, Peace Watch correspondent from WPFW, Pacifica Station in Washington, was in New York and files this report.
The eyes of the world were on the United Nations yesterday as the weapon inspectors turned in their report on Iraq. Many rallies opposing an attack on Iraq were held all over New York City, stating the people's response to these reports. Sean Ewald from WBIX.org, Refugees and Exiles Radio, joined the morning protesters and filed this report.
Outside the UN, approximately 20 protesters were arrested for blocking the street. Later that day, there was a demonstration in front of the German consulate. These are some interviews from that demonstration.
My name is Sean Goldack. We're hoping that Germany will use its current position on the Security Council to vote no to any resolution that would authorize force against Iraq. While we feel Germany might have a pivotal role to play, they're one of the most vocally anti-war countries in Europe, partly because of their history in general, but partly because the Green Party in that country is part of the governing coalition right now in Germany.
I am in the United States since December, and my son is in the army, and he's being deployed Wednesday, after tomorrow. He's going to Kuwait. I stay with him 40 days in North Carolina, where he's staying. When I came here, I said, well, anything I could do, I will try to do, now to give peace a chance, you know. He realized right before Bush, you know, came, and I was scared since then, and now I'm scared more, and it's been hard and sad.
How does your son feel about...
I was with him 40 days. He doesn't want to go, but they sign a contract, you know, and if he doesn't go, he'll be looked for everywhere he go, and it'll be very hard for him. No one there want to go.
This is Sean Ewald reporting for Peace Watch.
At noon, uptown near Harlem, the Riverside Church and the neighboring churches rang their bells in opposition to this war, and the neighbors held a vigil. At the front of the United Nations, Not in Our Name has called a big rally to oppose going to war against Iraq, irrelevant of the outcome of the arms inspector's report from that country.
This war, as everyone has said and as all of us know, is not some kind of abstract geopolitical notion. It's about life and death, and mostly death. The death of the Iraqi people, the death of the American soldiers who go there, the death of the soul of America, and the death of every single citizen in this country, because we are now living in a time in which the federal, state, and local government can barely provide basic services, and we are being asked to spend billions of dollars on a war of destruction that no one else thinks is necessary. So let us look for the moment when preemptive peace breaks out.
At 4 p.m., more than 200 people gathered in the freezing cold to tell the world that people in the United States will not go along with the war on Iraq and are determined to stop it.
In Central Park, at the event that Not in Our Name was part of, Meg Bartlett, an emergency medical worker who worked on the site of Ground Zero, made, on behalf of several other EMS workers, a statement from which I am about to quote. We, a group of 9/11 Ground Zero rescue workers, take this pledge of nonviolent resistance because we feel we have a responsibility to those we could not save, and to those who call us heroes, to do everything in our power to make sure that no one ever again experiences such horror here or abroad. We, a group of people who watched as mothers and fathers jumped to their death, take this pledge of nonviolent resistance because we believe it is unpatriotic to care for only American families. We believe that there is no competition in grief. We, a group of 9/11 uniformed public servants, take this pledge of nonviolent resistance because we resent our president telling us how we represent the best America has to offer while using our events, our efforts, and suffering as an excuse for further violence. Please know that we do not want to be repaid with vengeance, and we will not allow it to be perpetrated on our behalf. And there is simply no reason we cannot build a just and peaceful world.
Jeremy Golb, a hip-hop and youth organizer whose father died in the World Trade Center on September 11th, denounced violence against all people abroad and in New York City by armies and the police.
It's about 2 years and a few months since my father died, and his name is not safe. The Republican ruling class wants to use his memory and the memory of thousands of others who were sacrificed on 9/11 to justify everything from the escalation of aggression and U.S. imperialism against the Iraqi people, the continued war crimes committed against the Palestinian Fellahin, the rolling back of civil rights and human liberties for Arab and South Asian people in the U.S., and the propping up of heroes who have the blood of people like Amadou Diallo, Anthony Baez, the torture of Abner Louima under their name, people like Rudy Giuliani, who got something like a $4 million contract to go teach the Mexican police how to kill its masses of people. So what I'm saying is not only not in our name, but if you really, really want to show empathy with 9/11 family members, then you have to prioritize an Iraqi, Palestinian, Afro-American, Latino life the same way that you would prioritize a victim of the Trade Center, which includes all those people. But you cannot privilege an American life on 9/11 over a Palestinian Fellahin, or else you're, as Malcolm said, a white nationalist. If you really want to make a dent, if you really want to show your solidarity with people like me, people like my mother, and all those people, you really need to not allow the same Republican ruling class that decimated the Arab left, trained Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, who allegedly is responsible for the 9/11 attacks, and then wants to use those murders to justify the continued aggression against Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi people, who had nothing to do with 9/11.
Maliki McCall, what brings you out in this freezing cold? Why is it so important to you?
Because I believe that war is immoral, and it's unjust, and it is stupid at the best of times, at the worst of times, and we have no business going to war when we need to nurture people. Our children need education, our old people need to be looked after. There's people on the streets of this wonderful city here on this freezing cold day, and they're trudging around with old bags and dying here, and they want to kill more people. And that to me is absolutely outrageous. They're making me hate, and I don't like that in me.
You know what it's like when alone somebody cannot make the two ends meet.
Oh, I know that very well. I grew up in poverty. My three siblings died of disease and poverty. 11 of my classmates died in Limerick, in Ireland. And I look upon this and I say, we should be nurturing life, joyfully exhilarating in our life, instead of spending $200 billion on killing people.
Not in our name. Not in our name.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Reem Kathouda.
We'll be back in a moment.